Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, or simply want to get in touch, then please email info@mrdemillefm.com. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Mr. David Arnold. He obviously needs no introduction, having been the music writer of the second most number of Bond films after John Barry. And he spared some time from his busy schedule to sit down, and we're going to look at some of his favourite films and why he's picked them. First, I've got to ask you, David, this statistic with John Barry, how did that come about? Were you friends with him? Because he recommended you, didn't he?
I made a record in 1995-96 called Shaken and Stirred, because I've always been a Bond fan my whole life. Before I'd ever got anywhere with music, I always wanted to make a record of my favourite Bond themes. But every time you're no one and you phone up someone who's a someone, that someone is very unlikely to return your call.
Yeah.
But once I'd made The Young Americans and Stargate, all of a sudden people would return a call. So I knew I had a few months between Stargate and starting on Independence Day, and I thought, I want to try and make this record. So I started making it then, and the first three tracks I did You Only Live Twice with Björk, On Her Majesty's Secret Service with Propellerheads, and Diamonds Are Forever with David McCalmont. Those were the three starters, and I thought, I'll do these three, just see how I get on with them, take them around some record company, see if anyone's interested. No one was really interested, so I carried on making it on my own anyway. And it took about 8 months, 9 months of stopping and starting, waiting for people to be around. Now, in order to not step on anyone's toes, I thought I would send some of these tracks off to Eon, who make the Bond movies, Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, and saying, this is what I'm doing. I know that they're very protective of the franchise. What am I allowed and not allowed to say, put on artwork or videos, you know? And surprisingly, there is a copyright issue with, you know, stroking a white cat in a video, something like that. So I'm glad I asked, because I didn't want to upset anyone. Anyway, and one of those tracks, Barbara liked the sound of it, and they started putting it in to Tomorrow Never Dies, an attempt track, you know, when they put in existing tracks just to put in the background of a movie scene, just to see how it feels.
Oh, I see.
And they started using that and liked it. And then the record came out, and it did pretty well. And the story goes, John I'd met here, actually. George Martin introduced me to John here at Air Studios. John was recording something in Studio One, and George was, I think, co-producing or just popping in as a friend, you know. And they're both kind of titans, and they've both got amazing voices, neither of which I can replicate. But George knew that I was a big fan of John and his work, and he said, "Would you like to meet John Barry?" I said, "Yes, please." So he took me into the room, and he said, "Oh, George," you know, George said, "Oh, this is John. This is David. He's been recording some of your songs," and John was very nice about it. "Would you want to hear some?" "Yes, please." I played him a couple, and he loved it, and that was it. You know, I thought, I've met John Barry. Bucket list. Off you go. Introduced to by George Martin. Another bucket list. Fine. All right, go home. Rest easy. And then the story that Barbara Broccoli told me, was she was in HMV in Oxford Street, and she was buying a bunch of CDs of composers as they were looking for a composer of Tomorrow Never Dies. I don't think John could do it. And they just wanted someone new. And she bought a bunch of like soundtrack CDs up, and she was paying for them. And the guy behind the counter said, "Have you heard this?" And he pushed the Bond record at her. And she said, "I think I've heard some of these." And then he said, "Oh, and what about this?" And he gave a Stargate and Independence Day. And she bought those. And I think that's how it got in front of her a little bit. And then I think she spoke to John, and then John was nice about me, thank God. So somewhere in the world, there is an ex-HMV shop assistant that I owe a very large drink to, or a very small house.
for your dreams. You drift through the years, and life seems tame, till one dream appears, and love is its name.
Another film, very interesting, that you picked as one of your faves you wanted to mention was Pee-wee's Great Adventure, yes. Which is was the first film that Tim Burton directed and Danny Elfman did the music to. Yeah, yeah. What's your reason for picking this film? It's got that fantasy thing again that you love.
It's sort of ridiculous. Well, it is very ridiculous. I had this. It's got this iconic central performance, which I think there was no one like that guy, like Paul Rubens, you know, doing that character, and it was so childish. And I don't know if it's just me who likes childish things. I probably do. Occasionally I will put something, more than occasionally, on social media or something. I just put stupid stuff up, you know, and then I have to sort of qualify the fact that, you know, I'm 62 now, but I'm still doing this stuff like I'm 14. You know, it's incredibly juvenile. I think I like the naivety of the character. I thought the music was fantastic. I love the fact that it didn't seem to give a hoot what it was doing. You know, that it was just rampaging through all these things, and full of hugely quotable little bits and pieces. And I still show it to people. You know, it was on my 50th birthday. I had a Pee-wee Big Adventure screening party, because I thought, I want people to know that this is the sort of thing that I quite like. You know,
apparently the three writers, they didn't know how to write a script, and they bought a book, How to Write a Screenplay. And they followed what it said, apparently.
Well, there's loads of stories like that. Yeah, but watching Tim, you know, Tim kind of become Tim Burton, the film director in that movie, and Danny going nuts with that style, you know, and all of a sudden it's like, where have these two been? You know, all of a sudden you've got Tim Burton. The world of Tim Burton is now in existence. Where had that been forever? But it was fully formed. His world was fully formed.
Yeah.
And Danny Elfman sort of musical style for that, you know, that you know, his ability with sort of humor, comedy, action, and great melody, and very idiosyncratic arrangements, you know, and it seemed like unlike anything I'd ever seen before.
Thank you.
Looking at the next film that you've chosen on your list, it's another musical-based one, Cabaret.
Yeah.
Which is one of my great favourites. Won 8 Oscars, based on the Isherwood book, isn't it?
Yeah.
I Am a Camera. Tell me something about this that you like.
I think my history with this goes back to my parents' record collection, as a lot of these things would. They had a lot of musical soundtracks going back to the sort of glory MGM days with like Singing in the Rain or Oklahoma and Carousel. You know, classics. Carousel, like a heartbreaking idea. I saw a revival of it at the Regent Park Open Air Theatre, I think a year or two ago, and it's still like a stunningly powerful thing. But Cabaret was a soundtrack that my mum and dad had, and I remember listening to the opening of Cabaret, which was the MC song, and it had a little banjo and guitar lick at the start, which was a kind of that sort of Germanic willkommen, you know, it starts like that, and there is that sort of, it's equally naive and sinister and terrified and terrifying at the same time. And then when you kind of zoom out a little bit and you find out what it's actually about, because I thought as a teenager about a woman who sings in a nightclub and things go wrong for her, but you zoom out, you know, and you find out everything else that's going on.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, okay, that's what this is about. And then so my love for it came from the music first, and then I saw the movie with the Fosse direction and that choreography, and it was mind-blowingly powerful, because it was weirdly hugely modern, but at the same time it felt quasi classical at the same time, you know. It felt like accessible, exciting, dynamic costume design, hair and makeup, Minnelli extraordinary, you know, just one of those things where you had her in the center of it, who was the triple threat, you know, as being able to do all of these things brilliantly, singing, dancing, acting brilliantly.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those movies that it's in and of itself a complete thing. It's got its own ecosystem in a way, you know, emotionally and character design, choreography, music. It feels like it could only exist in this world of Cabaret.
Good point. You
know? And it's interesting, being a great piece of work, how often it has been adapted and performed. I mean, I've seen it 4, 5, 6 times, you know, different variations of it, from Jane Horrocks doing Sam Mendes of it down at the Donmar, you know, through various productions around the country. And there's a new one that I still haven't seen yet, which I know like Eddie Redmayne was in it, and it's a fantastic cast.
It's iconic, isn't it?
A completely different reading of it. And it stands, it can withstand all that, because it's just an extremely powerful piece of work.
Yeah.
Brilliant writing, fantastic book. You know, music, obviously, songs, incredible.
The sun on the meadow is summery warm. The stag in the forest runs free. But gather together to greet the storm. Tomorrow belongs to me. The branch of the linden is leafy and green. The Rhine gives its gout to the sea. But somewhere a glory of it's unseen. Tomorrow belongs to me. The babe in his cradle is closing his eyes. The blossom embraces the bee. But soon, says a whisper, arise, arise to
So now let's move on to something a bit with a bit more gravitas in a funny sort of way. And I mean, you've picked Taxi Driver, which of course is the amazing lesson in filmmaking: great direction, great script writing, great acting, great score, just everything. Everything works. Another film that sort of exists in its own little universe in a way. Yeah. Self.
I mean, I'm always interested in films and about what they're actually about, and it's a question that I always ask a director when they send me a piece of work or a script. A lot of the time, I find that a script is like a list of things that happens, and I go, okay, I understand that all these things happen in this order, and I come to the end of it and I think, but what's it actually about?
Mm.
And I know writing songs for films with, like, Don Black, I work with a lot, who's a lyricist, you know, amazing lyricist. If for anyone who doesn't know Don Black, he won the Oscar for Born Free, but he wrote To Sir With Love. He wrote the Bond songs, Thunderball, Man With The Golden Gun, Diamonds Are Forever, Andrew Lloyd Webber, musicals, you know, I mean, he's done everything. He always says to me, you know, I'll explain to him what's going on in the movie, and he'll go, but what's it about, Dave? What's it about? What's it actually about? And that's the only question that really matters.
Exactly.
Because when you're trying to write a song for a movie, you need to know what it's about.
Yeah.
And if it's like, if someone then explains to you, well, you know, he gets on a train and he goes over there and then he has a fight with them and then he gets on another train and there's a car chase, and goes, no, that's not what it's about. That's what's happening. You know, I need to know what it's about. And sometimes people don't really know what it's about. They just know that this stuff happens and they like the look of it, or it might be exciting.
Then you've got a free hand to decide what it's about.
You have to kind of then say, well, I think I'm going to tell you what I think it's about.
Well,
because if it's not anchored in some kind of truth. And what I love about, I think, again, every time I talk about these things, I learn something. And I think what I've just learned from listening to your introduction to that was that, like Pee Wee, like Cabaret, Taxi Driver is its own world.
Yeah.
It's so complete.
Mm.
It's so anchored in its own truth, in an absolute truth.
Mm.
And it's so anchored in real human emotions and conditions that you connect with it. You know, it's frightening and it feels like dangerous and you kind of want to know everything about everyone, but you're equally sort of repelled by it. And that startling score, I thought, you know, the score was just unbelievable. You know, the last score that Bernard Herrmann did. And a sort of like a minimalist sort of jazz based thing, but it was so modern in so many ways. But that was terrifying as well. Just the sound of it, not just the notes, but the sound of it was terrifying. And I think of Taxi Driver and I think of being enveloped in a completely different world, and that's what great movie making
does.
That's
what you want.
You find yourself in the center of somewhere that you've got no idea about, and someone is holding your hand and sort of taking you through the process, and it's the director and it's the actors and it's the script and it's the music and all these things. But
that's like a nice way of looking at it.
But that's so Taxi Driver is one of those films that exists in its own ecosystem.
So, David, you introduced me to a film which I'd never heard of, which I went and saw, called Nobody Knows from 2004. It was a Japanese film about a group of young kids, and the mother leaves them and they have to fend for themselves. And I'd never heard of this. It's a gripping film.
Yeah.
Can you tell me some more about why you like this?
Well, I think it's partly wedded to the experience of how I saw it. I was on a film jury with Maurice Jarre, was the other sort of musician, and Colm Meaney, some actors. And we were watching four or five movies a day as part of a film jury. And for me, that's like bliss, you know, watching for... I mean, that's what I used to do when I was younger, you know, if I had a day off...
And I'm getting paid for this.
I would watch... Well, I wasn't getting paid, but I was not having to do anything else, you know. This was my job for a week or two. And then you're in a room with these brilliantly talented people discussing it and saying, which one do we think should be given da-da-da-da-da. So you're able and you have to form an opinion on it and contribute to a discussion about it. And what I discovered in that and then subsequent film juries, I've seen some of the best films I've ever seen in my life at film festivals that have never got distribution, that I've never seen on TV. They just never go further than that screening at a film festival, which is sort of shocking in a way. And when people complain about the state of the film industry or the music industry, they're really only complaining about the top tier kind of Hollywood based thing, or, you know, whatever's on Radio 1 or 2. You know, in terms of what's in the world, there's so much more in the world that just doesn't get a spotlight shone on it. Nobody Knows was, it sort of caught me really off guard, because I have, you know, I love seeing them, but I've got no idea what it's about, no idea. And when you're at a film festival, you generally don't know, because, you know, they haven't been released. They might be looking for some sort of distribution. And it's qualified to enter for a film festival, so it's going to be seen by public for the first time.
And limited information about them too.
So I don't know anything about it. So you go and say, okay, what's this about? And for people who haven't seen it, it's such an original and amazing story. And it starts off with like a mother who comes with two very bulky suitcases and a 10 or 11-year-old son to what looks like quite a snooty apartment building in Japan. I can't remember where in Japan it was, in a big city in Japan. And she is being vetted by the people who live in this apartment block to see whether she's acceptable to be allowed to rent it.
Yeah.
The building board or whatever it is. And she has to say that her son is very quiet and he's very well behaved. And eventually they let her go in, and she's all dressed up nice, and she goes in and she shuts the door behind her into this apartment that they've given her on the basis that she's here with her nice, quiet 10-year-old son. And she opens up the suitcases and three other kids fall out of there.
That's right.
Which is just an extraordinary opening. And this 10-year-old, 11-year-old kid, the older kid, has to sort of look after these other younger ones who can't be seen to be in this apartment, otherwise they get kicked
out.
Because
she's away a lot of the time.
She's away a lot of the time. She leaves a pile of money on the table. She goes away. Part of the kid's job, the boy's little boy's job, is to go around the city collecting what we sort of discover is alimony from the various fathers of these children that this woman has had
relationships with,
until he comes home one day and there is a big pile of money on the table and a letter saying, I can't take this anymore and I've gone. And then the film is about this boy who is just about entering into teenagehood, and his siblings who are very young and have to be looked after. What happens? And he meets a girl, and so all of a sudden you've got this story about he's torn between his future and his responsibility to the kids. I mean, it's such a profound film, and moments of huge upset in it. But I remember thinking, like, it was so beautiful as an idea, so beautiful. And subsequently have thought how awful it is that hardly anyone sees it or has heard of it.
I
never saw it. I was on the lookout for it for a good couple of years, and I never heard it. I saw that it was on... Someone had done a VHS or a DVD of it a few years back, but did you manage to get it online?
I did find it. It is out there. I mean, that's one good thing about the internet is that some of these films, you can find them.
Yeah, like, I mean, the amount of work that I had to try and do to find it, I did track down a DVD of it a few years
ago. You did, yeah.
But, I mean, if it is digitally somewhere, then, you know, if anyone's listening to this and wants to watch it, I don't think you'd be disappointed. It's just a rare piece. And it's unlike, you know, the kind of movies that are in every multiplex, everywhere. You know, it's just a profound piece of filmmaking.
I agree. Here's some music from it. Tell me something about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That's another world in its of its own.
I'm discovering making. A pattern here that I hadn't previously conceived of. And it's quite interesting, isn't it, when you're forced to think about things. But it is. It's interesting. The more I think about it, the more I think that this is built of the same cloth in a way.
It is, isn't it?
Of a moment when you watch it, you are lost completely within its world, you know, to the exclusion of everything else outside of it.
And everything inside it makes sense in its own way.
And everyone in it belongs in that world and doesn't feel like they could belong anywhere else. They have this incredible central performance by Jack Nicholson. Again, music, like highly stylized music with, I don't know if it was bowed, whether it was a saw or, you know, it felt like sort of Native American stuff. There was flutes, there was percussion, there was a kind of bowed saw kind of sound in it. Again, stuff that I'd never heard before. And an introduction to a world, mental hospital, abuse of people in mental care, healthcare, and the faces that were in that movie. Christopher Lloyd, Danny DeVito, you know, people that went on to sort of huge success in
Danny DeVito's debut.
Yes. Yeah. And Christopher Lloyd, you know, Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Again, tragic beyond belief, but with an ending that is so, you know, you feel like a proper like air punch, you know, you feel like going into the cinema toilet and pulling out your own sink and throwing it through the door. You know, everyone has a story. That's what I loved about it.
Yeah.
The smallest character had a story. And each of those characters' stories were equally as fascinating as everyone else's.
Yeah.
And in a way, the Jack Nicholson one was kind of like a curator of these people.
Yes.
You know, and I know he took them out on that boat trip and, you know, and it was like hilarious. But it's like he curated the stories in that movie and the people in that movie. And they were all brought together by this singular character from having been completely separate. And then that's what's so tragic at the end when he's wheeled in after the operation back into the ward, that they all kind of slightly fall apart a little bit again, apart from the chief,
you know,
who decides to do something about it. But
and Kirk Douglas had, you know, he had the rights to this for years, like 20 years, and couldn't get anyone.
And Michael Douglas produced.
And Michael Douglas ended up producing it, didn't he?
And he must have been a child when he did that, though. I mean, like, was it in the 70s, early 70s, I think?
75. It must have been one of the first things he did.
Yeah, I mean, amazing.
Incredible.
Just in, he would have been, what, Streets of San Francisco?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, just after that.
At that point.
So, just after that, I think. And it's the just out of interest, it's Barack Obama's favourite film.
Is it?
And Ron Howard's favourite film.
All right. Well, that's quite good company, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
La plus beau roman de ma vie, Charmaine, c'est vous dont jamais je n'oublie les yeux si belles, si doux. C'est vous qui malgré mes folies. Mon seul amour, la seule que j'aime, que j'aime toujours. Charmaine, Charmaine, c'est vous. Tous les amants ont leur chanson, j'avais la mienne aussi. Et si je pleure sans raison, l'amour qui s'est enfui, il m'est pourtant resté. C'était il est mort, chantait. Le plus beau roman de ma vie, Charmaine, c'est vous dont jamais je n'oublie les yeux si bleus. C'est vous qui malgré mes folies, restez mon seul amour, la seule que j'aime, que j'aime toujours. Charmaine, Charmaine, c'est vous.
Now, David, you've got The Godfather written down here, but which part?
I've gone for the first one. Only I know the second one's a better film, maybe, but there's something about the impact of the first one. Probably the presence of Marlon Brando, the James Caan stuff, the early stuff, the birth of everything in that film, which led you into part two.
The rest,
you
know,
and part two was. Extraordinary exploration of the things that happened in one, but I just think it was the introduction of the idea of the world.
Yeah,
you know, we've done it again, haven't we? It's like to the exclusion of all else, these people were only existing in the world of the Godfather.
And again,
I keep saying the same things. There's an amazing central performance, whether it's Sean Connery or Pee Wee, or Jack Nicholson, or Liza Minnelli. You've got Marlon Brando, you've got Al Pacino, James Caan. You know, it's stuff that you just don't see anymore. You know, it's like, I remember Frank Zappa talking about the golden days of the music industry in the 70s. Was that when people who ran record companies were the big cigar chomping gangstery types? Who didn't pretend to know anything about music, you know, who would sit there and go, you go and make a record and I'll sell it.
Yeah.
I might not pay you anything for it, but I'll sell it.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to sit there and tell you what to do. That's when we had the best music.
Yeah. Same thing with
movies. I'd say, like, if you look at the kind of auteur-driven stuff, you know, the boldness of American cinema in the 70s. Again, only talking about sort of American sort of Hollywood-style cinema. British film was equally interesting. But, you know, they were run by sort of gangstery types, you know, maybe. Again, it was a bit of a cliche, you know, the guys with the braces and the slick-back hair and the cigars. Would be telling people to make their movies, and these people would be given the budgets to make it.
Yeah.
And then they would put them in the cinemas, and everyone would keep their fingers crossed.
Yeah.
But now it's like, you know, you're given notes on every single aspect of everything. Yeah. Got a note from the studio. The oboe's a bit too loud in bar four.
Yeah.
It's a demo, you know.
So it's sort of become formulaic?
I think so. I think it's people... maybe have understood that there is an audience for formulaic, then you're going to give them, you know, going back to the Coca-Cola analogy.
I wonder if
people like drinking Coke, knowing that it's not good for you. People are going to make Coke to sell it to the people who like drinking Coke.
I bet they don't even have any test screenings anymore. You know, they used to have screenings in.
I think they do have those things. Audience there, like, well, and they'll just kick things out.
And change a movie completely.
Yeah, like some guy said he didn't like, you know, does it have to be about a shark, Mr. Spielberg? Yeah, some guy saw the test movie and he didn't like the shark.
Can we do
it without a shark? Instead of just like, why are we listening to him?
I have but one heart, this heart I bring. I have but one heart to share with you. I have but one dream that I can cling to. You are the one dream I pray comes true. My darling, until I saw you, I never felt this way, and nobody else before you ever has heard me say, you are my one love, my life I live for you. I have but one heart to give to you. Vicino mare, facciamo amore, a cuore a cuore, per trespassare. So mare nare, et tenerezza, ma pallarezza, stunga morì. My darling, until I saw you, I never felt this way. And nobody else before you ever has heard me say, you are my one love, my life I live for you. I have but one.
So, David, I've got to ask you, because you've got a Western in here. Do you like Westerns?
As a genre, I think the only one that I really took to was the spaghetti westerns, the Morricone scored Clint Eastwood, you know, Fistful of Dollars trilogy. That was the one that really got my attention.
The one that we're talking about, Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah, I mean that's not part of that trilogy. I have to say it's. I really struggle to find which one to talk about. I think Once Upon a Time in the West is a more profound story, and it's a longer story, and it's a more in-depth story. But I love the iconography of, again, we are in the same territory. We've got this central performance, and we've got this world that can only exist for these people in these places, like Eli Wallach and the, you know, that music, which I've still struggled to understand how you could ever really conceive of that sound for a Western. I mean, most of the time the Westerns had been like the John Waynes, you know, and it had been quite rambunctious and, and sort of oddly American. But this didn't sound American, you know. And the dubbing changed your opinion of it as well. It felt slightly otherworldly. And the fact that your central character never spoke and the music did pretty much all the heavy lifting in terms of how you felt about everything. But ocarinas, recorders, guitars, screaming, whistling.
I mean, harmonicas.
I mean, it's like it was just, where does that come from? I did interview Ennio Morricone once, and I tried to ask him, and he was very reluctant to say. I think he felt a little bit insulted that I'd even asked him. Because it's a bit like saying, how did you do that? You know, but I wasn't really asking how did you do that. I was asking, why did you do that?
Because maybe he didn't know.
Because we can't separate those things anymore. You know, having grown up with that film, with those other films, you can't separate that music from those images. And the fact is that the music only exists because the images exist. Or certainly the story exists, because I know that Morricone sometimes would write based on script ideas, not necessarily just a picture. But the design and the Panavision, you know, the color correction, you know, that made it so specifically those films. There's never been anything like it. Well, actually, that's true. There's been a million things like it, because it was so influential, but there hasn't really been anything as good as or as an original as. And in terms of Westerns in general, I mean, I like Dances with Wolves, you know, that was, I don't know if that's technically a Western. I know it's set in the West, partly because of the John Barry score, partly because of the sort of romantic scale of it, you know, the ambition of it visually, and the way it was shot, all that stuff was lovely. But I wouldn't say I was like a huge fan of Westerns per se, but those spaghetti Western things were like punk rock in a way, weren't they? You know, it's like in the world of
that's
cinema.
That's a nice way of putting
in the,
it.
In the world of cinema, it was just like, never seen that before, never heard that before. And it makes me want to see and hear more of it.
A new
and
way
B,
of doing things.
Want to do it myself as well, you know, hugely inspiring.
There's something really odd about Once Upon a Time in the West, and that is that Lionel Stander, who's in it, got quite a large part in it for him. And for the American version, all his scenes were cut. So poor old Lionel Stander's character got trashed.
Well, it is amazing, isn't it? You think like that, but, you
but
know,
it
a piece
didn't
of...
succeed in America, so there you go.
Yeah, well, I suppose it maybe it's a bit too alien. You know, there was something very otherworldly about it.
Yes.
And in a country where the story of the West was an American story.
They probably, probably made them feel uncomfortable.
An Italian doing it.
Yeah.
Made a lot of difference, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you.
Now, I saw something that on your list that I'd never seen, because I thought you were talking about the original, The Little Shop of Horrors, the Roger Corman movie, God rest his soul, this week.
Yeah.
But you were talking about the musical, which I saw, and I actually say I don't normally enjoy musicals, I have to say, but I loved it, and I loved I loved Steve Martin's dentist and the patient that comes in wanting to be hurt.
Yes,
Bill Murray. I thought it was wonderful.
And not only a guy who wanted to be hurt by a dentist, but a dentist who wanted to hurt his patient.
Yes.
Much to his frustration, everything that he wanted to do to hurt people.
Yeah, but in the end, he called. He said, "You're a sicko. Get out of here." He couldn't take it, could he?
I mean, it was a really, really funny scene, and Steve Martin was amazing in it. Again, it was one of those. It was one of those movies that over a summer, I think I just watched. I just watched so many times.
Yeah.
I love the fact that they had like the lead singer of the Four Tops singing The Plant.
Yes.
You know, the soul, amazing soul voice, and the songs were extraordinary. Sort of hark back to those sort of 50s doo-wop stuff.
Yes.
The fact that
there was different style about all the music, wasn't there?
Yeah,
which was good.
Yeah, it had that kind of 50s, 60s, you know, partial sort of doo-wop and Phil Spector and Motown.
Yeah, they all hung together very well, I thought.
Yeah, sort of slightly gospely, slightly soulful. And again, performance is brilliant, but the ridiculousness of it, again, I loved. And also just the enthusiasm with which Frank Oz directed that film and let the comedy performers really do their stuff, you know.
Yes.
Because Frank, as a, you know, was Fozzie Bear and Yoda, you know, as a film director, understands comedy. You know, he understands where the laughs are, but he also understands where the heart of things are. And you feel, I felt like watching the movie, that he gave so much leeway to people to be brilliant and captured those moments and assembled them together.
Yeah.
But he had those amazing songs as well. So the music and the songs were Alan Menken and Howard Ashman, who went on, I think, to write The Little Mermaid and several movies for Tangled for Disney, and won what went to be known as the Alan Menken Award, because he would win the Best Song Oscar every year for the songs that he wrote for the Disney films. It was
quite nice.
He's quite a talent. But that is my, the songs in that I just absolutely adore. Again, brilliantly, you know, the lyrics are brilliant to sing. They're the right words with the right space and the right time.
Yeah, that struck me. The lyrical content of the song was very clever.
Yeah. No,
it was very good.
I absolutely loved it. And there's something about musical performers, West End or Broadway performers. They are so incredibly technically gifted, emotionally gifted. They can almost do anything. I know when I was working with them, we'd be reworking songs in the afternoon. They would perform the old version of the song in the evening in front of the public. We'd be rehearsing a different version of it the next day, and we'd be mixing and matching these things and giving them all new instructions.
And yet they'd keep it.
And they'd remember everything.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the things about West End performers and Broadway performers is that they are so incredibly adept at changing and taking direction and doing a different show from one hour to the next. There is a moment where in Suddenly Seymour, where she loses the kind of baby doll voice and goes into full voice.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, it was like, in that one note, it was like in The Wizard of Oz, where we went from black and white to colour to widescreen. You know, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, hold on, this is a completely different thing now. And I remember being, like, incredibly excited and moved by that performance.
Mm.
I think it's the only time I've ever actually written a fan letter to anyone and said, like, I just thought that was amazing. I never heard back from her. But Little Shop of Horrors, always a favourite.
You don't know what you're missing, baby. to save your hide. You want to see tomorrow? You better step aside. Better take a tip, boy. Want some good advice? You better take it easy, cause you're walking on thin ice.
So, David, the final film we've got on the list that you sent me is Flash Gordon from 1980.
Yes.
The film with the Queen soundtrack, isn't that correct?
It is, yes.
And they had a plan for a string of these films, but the first one was such a disaster that they were all scrapped. So tell me something about this film.
Yeah, it wasn't a disaster for me. It's one of the best times I've ever had in a cinema. Yeah, I mean, I was sort of a big, amongst other things, I really loved the ambition and the ridiculousness of Queen as a band. And I knew what I liked about them, you know, and I'd seen them live quite a few times. So I was a big Queen fan. And when Flash Gordon came out, obviously there was a soundtrack album which came out first with songs. Interestingly, the score for that was written by Howard Blake, who wrote The Snowman, Walking in the Air. Who's still around and still writing, but the songs and the song score, I think, was chiefly Brian May's work. I think he was more into it. There was more sort of rock based element in it.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad used to love Flash Gordon, and when I was about 7 or 8, on Saturday mornings, he used to have kids cinema,
yeah,
at the Odeon in Luton, and I used to get on a bus. And go down to the cinema, and I would watch the Saturday morning films, which there'd be two short films, usually a Children's Film Foundation one about some kid who loses a rabbit in a garage, yeah. you know, and then preceded by an old episode of Flash Gordon.
Ah.
The Buster Crab one, the black and white ones.
Right.
And then you'd have your main feature would be something like Hannibal Smith or something, you know.
Right.
Fairly harmless film that you could watch. And I used to watch that every Saturday. And my dad used to tell me that he used to watch Flash Gordon when he was a kid as well, Buster Crab.
Hmm.
And so probably my interest in it came from that. And when they were doing it up, I heard the music first, and then I saw some of the photographs of the sort of costume design and the spaceships and the world, and I thought, this is again something else, you know. It was post Star Wars, and what I loved about it was that despite being set in space with similar armies of, you know, whatever they were, bearing no relation whatsoever to Star Wars, you know, not caring about Star Wars in any way, shape or form.
Apparently, George Lucas, he wanted to make the Flash Gordon, but he couldn't get the rights.
Right.
So he ended up making up his own version, which is why we got Star Wars, which is quite funny.
I mean, it was so camp, though. You know, I think the Italian designs, there's a lot of Italian talent on the show. The costume design and everything was so camp and so highly styled, you know. It was it was like sort of just a really sort of odd fashion show, some of it. And again, it's one of those things that I'll watch it once a year and still feel the same as I did when I saw it. It's still full of joy, and you get a feeling that everyone was having the time of their life. But for me, just the audacity of it.
We'll be right back.
I'm so glad you you took the time to speak with me. It's been fascinating, and
I'm so pleased that you spoke to me, Hugh, because I've discovered the link in all there of these you go. Things. You know, it's like
it's interesting, isn't it?
A world.
Yeah,
you know, like literally, like in the in the trailer voiceover, in a world, you know, these are the world that you are in when you're watching them, much more than so many other films that I've seen. I think
it's a great body of work here that you've chosen, and it's a first for me because there's a couple of movies there that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah, and now I've discovered what it is that I like about it.
There you go. We both got something out of it. That's great. So, David Arnold, all the best with everything you're working
Thanks
on now.
You.
And let's go out with Suddenly Seymour.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me.
Lift up your head. Wash off your mascara. Here, take my Kleenex. Wipe that lipstick away. Show me a face clean as the morning. I know things were bad, but now they're okay. Suddenly Seymour is standing beside you. You don't need no makeup. Don't have to pretend. Suddenly Seymour is here to provide you sweet understanding. Seymour's your friend.
Nobody ever treated me kindly. Daddy left early, Mama was poor. I meet a man and I follow him blindly. He'd snap his fingers at me. I'd say sure. Suddenly Seymour is standing beside me. He don't give me orders. He don't care. To provide me sweet understanding. Seymour's my
Tell me this feeling lasts till forever. Tell me the bad times are clean washed away.
Please understand that it's still strange and frightening. For losers like I've been, it's so hard to say. Suddenly
Suddenly Seymour,
he purified
you.
Suddenly Seymour,
Suddenly Seymour,
show me I can.
Yes, you can.
Suddenly Seymour,
the girl that's inside you, with sweet understanding.
Understand.
With sweet understanding.